Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, April 22nd. I'm Ray Graff. Today we talk science with Barbara Brabets, Kevin Knuth, and Ed Stander. They're ready to answer your questions about biology, chemistry, geology, and physics, whatever else you might throw at them. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Yes, it's the Science Forum. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. The Science Forum, your calls coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's the Science Forum today, and today we welcome Barbara Brabets, a professor of biology and chemistry at SUNY Cobleskill for over 20 years. Dr. Ed Stander is a professor of geology, astronomy, and environmental sciences at SUNY Cobleskill. And Dr. Kevin Knuth is a SUNY Albany physics professor, and we're happy to have all three of them here today. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 if you have a science question for the crew. And if it's not in that particular range of scientific expertise, give it a shot anyway. This crew likes to try and answer things they don't know anything about, much like most of us here on the radio. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org if you wish. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabets, welcome back.
Alphabetically, I'm first, Ray. Nice to talk with you.
You're first on my list here, and I got to say one thing, that in the 13 months that we have been doing these shows with no guests in the studio, I have had a rule that only two guests tops, because we take calls and it can be crazy. But you said, no, we're going to bring Ed on as well today. And so if Ed misbehaves and gets in trouble, it's on you. Is that okay?
I have the eject button the way you do. It's right here on Zoom. I can make him gone in a minute. Actually, less than a minute.
That fills me with great confidence. And Ed Stander, welcome. How you doing?
Oh, I'm here too, and I'm filled with great confidence as well.
Really? Well, I'm glad you came. And a newcomer to the Science Forum, Kevin Knuth, the Albany physics professor. Welcome back. We did a show a couple of months ago. Nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I don't know if you've ever heard this show, Kevin, but basically we'll just throw some topics out there and the listeners call in with whatever they want. It could be anything from particle physics to hanging of laundry and why it smells fresher, and then our science team does their best to figure it out. So without further ado, there are a couple things in the news that I wanted to run by you guys, and then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. This is on our own website today, and it's everywhere. Out of thin air, NASA rover makes oxygen from Martian atmosphere. After making the first ever powered flight on another world, NASA's Mars 2020 mission has managed another key first. It announced that an instrument aboard the rover had successfully extracted carbon dioxide from the atmosphere on Mars and then electrochemically split oxygen atoms from carbon dioxide molecules. And it's, you know, the Martian atmosphere is like 95% carbon dioxide. So this is a big deal if we ever want to live there or fly back, I suppose. Who would like to give me some background on this? Barbara, is that your thing?
Sure, I'll start. I just wanted to kind of start off with saying that trees and plants everywhere here on Earth are so upset that this has somehow gotten an advertisement on Mars, because they do this regularly every day and don't get much props for it. But this little unit on the rover puts out about as much oxygen as a typical tree would put out within a day. And it harnesses the solar energy from the sun to then run basically an electrolysis reaction, so zapping it with electricity and making the atoms jump away from one another. And then for every carbon dioxide, they rip one oxygen off, and then they take another carbon dioxide, rip another oxygen off, and then smush those two together and make the oxygen, the dioxygen, O2, which is what we breathe.
You know, the experiment itself, which I forget, the MOXIE is, I guess, the name of the experiment, it produced 5 grams of oxygen, which is about enough for an astronaut to breathe for 10 minutes. I wonder how long it would take or how big of a machine it would take to make enough for a group of astronauts to live for a year. It seems like this is a very small step, Ed.
It's not too small. Anybody want to take that?
I think Ed left us.
It was one little unit. The thing is the size of a two-slice toaster. It's not that big. It does run very hot, so they have to worry about not baking other parts of the rover. But if this had a place to sit somewhere where it could generate the oxygen and then that oxygen could be collected, this is a viable alternative. This is why it flew all the way to Mars to go try it out.
Yeah, and you consider that it's a 30-pound unit, and they want to put a one-ton unit up there. So if you can scale that correctly, that's a lot of oxygen. Of course, it's not enough to change the atmosphere so people can live in it, but it is enough with nitrogen that's already there to keep them pretty satisfied for a long period of time.
How heavy is the unit they want to make there?
One tons.
All right. Well, I'll throw this to Kevin Knuth, our physicist. To send a one-ton piece of gear to Mars would require an awful lot of rocket fuel, right?
Yeah, certainly. But a lot of the equipment we've put up there, satellites are already quite heavy. So this is something that can be done.
All right. Well, we'll see how that one pans out. The other one really perplexes me, and I'll throw this to our scientists. We'll start with Kevin on this. Results from two experiments in the U.S. and Europe are shaking the world of particle physics. Decades ago, scientists created the Standard Model, and that's the basic rule book, how particles and forces sort of behave. And then they've been doing these experiments with muons. I guess they're something like electrons. I'm not exactly sure what a muon is, but apparently there's a magnetic field involved that they didn't account for, Kevin Knuth, and it's throwing things a little out of whack.
Right. So a muon is basically a heavy electron. About 200 times heavier than an electron is, but it has the other properties are similar. And these particles act like they're spinning, so they're like little spinning electric charges, and that generates a magnetic field. So they have a small magnetic field associated with them. And years ago at Brookhaven National Labs, they had an experiment to measure the magnetic field from a muon, and that magnetic field turned out to not agree with the calculations that had been performed using the Standard Model, which is the model that physicists have of how elementary particles behave. So there was a disagreement between the experimental results and the theory. And so now the more recent news is that we have an experiment in Fermi Lab has been performed that has now also measured the magnetic fields of these muons, and that quantity that they measured agrees with what was measured at Brookhaven National Labs. So now we have confirmation that the experimental results were do deviate from the Standard Model. Now, this is So it's interesting because we now have scientists disagreeing with each other, which happens, and this is how science works. And there is another collaboration, a theoretical collaboration, where they have been working to calculate this magnetic dipole moment of the muon using what's called lattice quantum chromodynamics. So basically, they are simulating the behavior of these particles and using that to calculate, using the simulations to calculate the magnetic field of the muon. And they're finding now that their calculations are agreeing with the experimental results. So now we have a disagreement in the ways that the theorists are actually calculating this magnetic moment, but it's now not clear whether the experimental results are anomalous or not. So now it's an interesting situation. So it's not clear that there's new physics here. It just could be that the Previous calculations weren't correct. The previous calculations are very difficult to do. If you do them by hand, it's a horrible amount of work. And they had used as shortcuts, they used experimental results from different experiments as, you know, in place of parts of the calculations. And that's possible that that's caused problems. So there could be other problems floating around that that are the cause of this. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yes, indeed. Let's take a quick break here. It's the Science Forum. We'll get to your calls in a moment at 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Ed Stander, Kevin Knuth, and Barbara Brabets. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And we'll be right back. It's Vox Pop. It's the Science Forum. Ray Graff with you. The number is 800-348-2551. We are joined today by Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, and Kevin Knuth. And this email came from Tim. And Tim writes, I know of three or four instances in the last 40 years where a rear wheel has come off the axle on the highway for one reason or another. The one noticeable constant is that the tire slash wheel accelerates and goes past the truck. A little disconcerting for the driver. How is this possible? And that is from Tim. And who wants this?
Boy, I don't want to drive with Tim.
Yeah, right.
All right. Well, Barbara, you spoke first, so go ahead.
Oh, boy. I have unfortunately seen this happen on my own car twice, and my husband knows about both, so I'm not revealing anything that I'm going to get in trouble for.
Okay.
Well, you think about it. You've got energy that's stored in that tire, and you're having to impart energy upon that tire in order to move a mass. When that tire is no longer attached to the mass, it still has energy, the same amount of energy, but now it can express itself in a different way, and that is it can go faster, but it still has the same, it's dissipating the same amount of energy as it would if it was rolling under the car. Mm-hmm. That's how I do it without any math and without a whiteboard. Anybody want to add some more components to that?
And I guess I can add a little. I would imagine that, you know, once your tire comes off, your car is going to be slowing down to some degree. So that's perhaps a factor as well. I would.
That's what I would say.
Yeah, very true. This email from, here we go. This will be a long conversation. This is from Joel in Blooming Grove. What is antimatter? Where is it? Is it quantifiable? Is it related to dark matter or dark energy? Thank you. Well, thank you, Joel.
Wow.
All right. Ed, you go first.
Antimatter. Antimatter is effectively the opposite of matter. It has the opposite charge. For example, you may have an electron that has a negative charge, and the opposite of that would be the positron, which has a positive charge. And when the negative charge and the positive charge get together, they annihilate each other and produce energy and probably a little bit of light. So that's basically what antimatter is. Now, it can't exist very long in our existence, but it's quite possible at the beginning of time, during the Big Bang, there was matter and antimatter being produced at the same time. And they annihilated each other, which produced a huge amount of energy. And of that, we are sort of lucky because the matter was slightly more than the antimatter, which is why we have what we have here. So that's the first part of the question. What is dark matter? Dark matter is something which may or may not exist, but it's effectively a placeholder that it appears that galaxies and the like have something which is holding them together, which we don't see. And calculations based on readings on how much energy these galaxies have when they're rotating suggest that about 90% of what's out there is probably something we can't see or dark matter. Now that's...
This is another example of where science observes something and quantifies a phenomenon, and then we can't quite get the math to work. Just like Kevin was talking about earlier, where you have your theoretical calculations versus your empirical evidence, and they don't quite match. And I was thinking while Kevin was talking that that's kind of like my checking account. Like in theory, I have all the receipts. So if I add them all up, it should be what's there in the bank. But then I go and look in the bank and it isn't, it's never more, right? It's always less. But in this case, in both of these examples, it's more. What we found when we empirically measure is that there's more energy in the bank or more magnetism in the bank than we can account for. And now what we're trying to find is where are those extra deposits coming from?
Which of course is impossible, because if you have any bank account, you know very well there's going to be less money in the bank than there should be.
Well, maybe antimatter is the fees. Kevin Knuth, what do we know? What is the state of the art knowledge on dark matter, and what's your opinion on it? I mean, I've heard of scientists, I think ones in Israel, who did a study and said there really isn't dark matter. This is gravity behaves differently at a long distance. What is your opinion?
Right. It's a good question, and it's a matter of debate at the moment. There is, as Ed described, the rates at which the galaxy rotate depends on all the stars in the galaxy are basically rotating or swirling around their center of mass. And the rate at which they do this, the speeds that they move at, are dependent on how much mass is present. So we know that so from looking at these speeds, we know how much mass should be there. And then when we do observations with telescopes to look at these stars and try to add up all the mass that we see, we don't see most of the mass that we see is it's only 10% of what or so of what should be there. And so we infer that there's got to be something else present that has mass holding the galaxy together. There are other examples where we see missing mass. There's a cluster of galaxies called the Bullitt Cluster, where two galaxies have passed through each other. I'm rather new to radio. I find myself gesticulating here and on Zoom. And,
feel free.
And I know that you can't see this.
It's all right.
So imagine hand motions of two galaxies passing through each other. And they... And there is a region where the stars from these two galaxies are moving in a way that doesn't appear to depend on the mass of the observable mass of the two galaxies. So we infer that the dark matter has somehow separated from the visible matter. In that situation, we can actually create a picture of where the dark matter has to be for the speeds of the stars to all work out. So I think there's certainly evidence that that we do not understand something about mass and the gravitational attraction. Now the question is the problem that we are not seeing all the mass that's present, or is the problem that our theoretical formulation of gravity is not quite correct? And this is difficult. It's not obvious what the answer is. So we have groups of scientists trying out variations on the theories. Right now, the best theory we have is Einstein's general theory of relativity, which in many cases works very, very well. And so we don't have a lot of reason to doubt that there's a problem with Einstein's general theory of relativity, but we do have many theorists who are now thinking, well, let's rethink this. Maybe it's the theory's missing something. Maybe we've done something wrong. Maybe it can be improved. You have that going on, and then you also have experimental work going on trying to see if they can detect dark matter. Can we detect dark matter in the lab? Can we detect it by looking in space? And if we can detect it in the lab, then can we learn what its properties are? So that's there's a big question here. There's something to be learned. We don't know what it is yet. We know that something's wrong, and we're going to figure it out.
Well, let's hit the phones here. It is Vox Pop. It is the Science Forum. Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, and Kevin Knuth join us today. And once again, it's 800-348-2551. Bob in Broad Albany. Bob, you're on.
Yeah, thank you very much. Interesting comments and responses previously. The angular momentum of a wheel compared to the momentum of a 2-ton automobile says that wheel goes fast. I'm curious about the last questioner, and I do have a question, by the way, that involves magnetic fields. On your last issue with the Israeli, it's a MOND, a modification of Newtonian gravitational dynamics that he proposed, but there is a more modern issue with respect to multiverse influence in our universe of galaxies, billions of them, affecting gravitational field. But my question focuses on, I have two powerful magnets in my hands. I want to put them a quarter of an inch apart. I have the like poles together a quarter of an inch north to north, south to south, and they strongly repel. I put a south pole with a north pole a quarter of an inch apart, and they will attract. I am looking for a material from the periodic table, creating a sheet of that material, either an element or a compound, put between the two magnets, and I want to neutralize the field influence between the two magnets themselves. That's your challenge.
Why do you want to do that?
I want the answer to the question.
Aha!
I don't know whether you have an idea.
I see. It's a test. All right, Ed, you go first.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's not my bailiwick. I'll give it to Barb.
All right, Barb.
We're having a fire drill, so I'm going to mute myself.
All right, let's go to Kevin.
Great. Wow.
You know, it goes back to the era of stumping the professor.
Yeah, well done, sir. Well done.
All right. Yeah, I had a lot of fun doing that.
Right. So the only materials you could put in there that would be affected would be something that's ferromagnetic. So that's material that has where the atoms have magnetic dipole moments, much like the muons we were talking about earlier. And these materials, these dipole moments line up and kind of add together, which is what makes it makes the material magnetizable. You can affect it with magnetism. So iron, nickel, and cobalt would be ideal for that.
You're misunderstanding.
Go ahead.
No,
Bob.
You're misunderstanding me. I'm wanting to eliminate the influence of the two magnets upon each other. I'm attempting to shield the magnetic field between them. Eliminate it.
Yes. So I was getting there because you had asked.
Magnetic, but.
Okay, Bob. I think Kevin's going right there. Yeah. Go ahead, Kevin.
So a ferromagnetic material isn't going to work because you're just going to basically line those two magnetic fields are just going to line up the magnetic dipole moments in the material, and you'll still have
yes,
influence. So the only thing you can do is that I can think of is you could use a superconductor. Superconductors exclude magnetic fields. So if you put a superconducting material between the two, then the magnetic field from one magnet can't get through the superconductor to affect the other and vice versa.
All right, Bob.
Okay, if you say so.
All right,
thank you.
Hey, man, thanks a lot for that one. staying up at night, working up that question. Vern and Lee. Vern, you're on.
Yes, hello. I'm looking for the empirical evidence that the Earth is spinning.
Ah. Okay, well, let's go to our geologist.
Yeah, there's two pieces of empirical evidence that the Earth is actually spinning, and it isn't everything spinning around us. The first and the most accurate is probably the Foucault pendulum, which is effectively a pendulum that swings back and forth. You've probably seen them at science museums. And every once in a while, there's these little knobs that sit on the floor. And I'm using my hands now. The little knobs that sit on the floor, and every once in a while, the pendulum swings and knocks one of them over. And effectively, what that means is that since the only thing that's operating on the pendulum is gravity, which is downward, the fact that the pendulum is changing direction suggests that it's not the pendulum that's doing it, but the ground underneath that's changing direction. And that gives proof that the Earth is spinning. If the pendulum were located at the North Pole, it would take 24 hours to go around. If the pendulum was located at the equator, it would never change because it'd be moving the same direction as the equator. So you can calculate based on that at different latitudes how long it would take for the pendulum to go around. And from that, you can figure out the speed of the rotation of the Earth separately. So that's one of the proofs.
Okay.
The other proof is the Ekman spiral. The fact that winds on the Earth should be coming from north to south, at least in the northern hemisphere, but they don't. They go from west to east, and they do that because the Earth is spinning. And that change of spin between the equator and the North Pole causes, for example, hurricanes to form. And those hurricanes always have a particular direction. So that sort of thing would not happen on a spinning Earth.
You all right with that, Vern?
Actually, with your first example, isn't that Earth-based Coriolis with the Foucault pendulum?
No, Coriolis requires a large area to work. The only thing that would cause that pendulum to spin couldn't be Coriolis force, because that's too small. Some people argue that when you flush a toilet, the water going around is Coriolis force. It's not. It's just the shape of the toilet.
Okay.
So I'm not referring to a force.
That's a large area.
Go ahead, Vern. Wrap it up here.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, man. You keep going.
Okay. Okay. So is two reference frames at the pendulum? So is there two reference frames? Is that why you see the pendulum do its thing?
Well, the thing is that the pendulum only has one force operating on it, and that's gravity. And so it swings back and forth as a result of that, and that's straight down. So there should be no reason for the pendulum to change direction. But since we're on the Earth, effectively, our reference frame with respect to the pendulum is changing, which is why the pendulum appears to be spinning.
Okay. Well, I'm going to respectfully disagree. And I think that if the Earth was spinning, we would see it would be blatantly obvious, and we would see differences in flight times. I know it's not a very popular view, but it's becoming more popular.
All right, well,
thank you for your time.
Thanks, Vern. We'll throw this quickly to Barbara Brabitz. Barbara, do you have any counter argument for Vern?
Well, the Coriolis effect, which Ed referenced with Ekman spirals, is really just about drag. I mean, you can do it on a beach ball with paint and see how on a sphere, because we have slight differences in how long it takes to get around a rotation, that you're going to get this spiral. So I'm not going to fight on the pendulum argument, because gravity is gravity.
Okay.
You really fight that one. But as far as the Coriolis effect goes, you can do it in your own home and test the theory.
Kevin Knuth, you want to add anything to that?
Not really. I mean, I think the Foucault pendulum is the best example, in that as the pendulum swings, it's going to be swinging in a plane, and that the only force, as Ed was describing, is the force of gravity pulling the pendulum down, which is what, you know, if you pull the pendulum up and let it go, it falls back down, right? That's the only force. And if you let a pendulum go, you can try this at home, you let the pendulum go and it'll swing in a plane. But over time, what you see is that plane rotates and rotates around, so the direction in which the pendulum is swinging is changing. And there's no forces that are making that happen. So the question is, why would that be changing? And if you were to step off the Earth and look, you'd see that the pendulum is actually keeping the same orientation. It's actually still is swinging in that same plane. But what's happened is the Earth is rotated. That's really the best example.
All right,
it's all about your frame of reference, right? So we're all on things, objects that are spinning. We're on a spinning Earth. We're in a spinning solar system. We're in a spinning galaxy. So where's your frame of reference? That's you always have to take some reference of stationary and then go from there.
Right. And the caller noted that, you know, if the Earth was spinning, it would be blatantly obvious. Well, the pendulum is the blatantly obvious example of that. I agree.
All right, let's take a quick break here. We're joined today by Barbara Brabitz, Ed Stander, and Kevin Knuth. It's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Joined today by Kevin Knuth, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabitz. And let's see, who has been waiting? Oh, my heavens. Jim and Madam Morris. Jim, you're on.
I've got an old picture tube television that, even when it's turned off, it makes the booming noise. It sounds like alternating current coming through the sound system.
You're killing me, man. You bring this up on every science forum. Anything new to report?
I was waiting for somebody that would be able to answer it, maybe.
All right, man. All right. To recap,
Jim, weren't you going to send us a video? Didn't we ask for a video last time so we could understand the throbbing that you're talking about?
No, I don't know how to do that anyway.
Okay. anyway, it doesn't happen when it's unplugged, right?
Right.
No, he said it does.
When the television is turned off,
right,
it's still doing it.
But when it's
I don't know if you can hear it or not. I just turned it on.
When it's unplugged, it doesn't do it, though, right?
Right. Electricity is off, it doesn't do it.
All right, so unplug it. All right. Let's throw it to our physics professor from SUNY Albany, Kevin Knuth. Kevin, Jim is a regular caller on this program, and he's over the last several months had an issue with his TV that makes a booming noise even when the TV is off. What do you think?
Wow, that's a good question. If the TV's doing anything when it's off, I would say that it's probably due to charge being stored up in the capacitors in the television. So it's the old cathode ray tube televisions had rather large capacitors. These are little electronic devices that store electricity or store electrical charge. And it can be quite dangerous to take apart an old television because they can store enough charge to give you a good shock. So you don't want to just, even if the TV is unplugged, you don't just want to reach in there with your fingers and start grabbing things.
That's a good point.
I would guess that one of these capacitors, one or more of the capacitors is still holding a charge and it's somehow being discharged through the audio system if it's a boom coming through your audio system.
Oh, that's a great answer. Jim, what do you think?
Well, when you turn it on, there's no picture anymore since this started happening. Oh. But I just woke up one morning and there it was pounding away.
Wow.
Well, once again.
I think it's time to set that one.
We've got power supply, systems control, transformer. Ray said rodents. And that was about the only thing I could check out.
Rodents. Well, sorry, Jim. Maybe on the next show we'll have more information for you. But, I mean, it's good to know that your radio still works and you're still with us. Jim, thanks very much for the call. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Now we go to Chris in Housatonic. Chris.
Yeah, I got a question for you.
Okay.
Every time I'm outside, two questions. I noticed the back of the commercial plane's vapor trail is like a pinkish color. And the second question is there any, is there anything like the Bermuda Triangle in the Atlantic?
Goodness. Oh, that's a good question. Barbara Brabitz.
Yes, Ray.
So, first of all, the plane with the pink stuff coming out of the back.
Well, it's not pink coming out of the back. It might appear pink.
Okay.
But the vast majority of what comes out of a combustion of a jet engine is water vapor and carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
The white stuff we see off the back is when the water vapor turns into instant ice crystals when the conditions are just so that they don't evaporate right away.
Yeah.
When the humidity is a little higher and when it's cold up there. As we all know with rainbows, and if you look through a droplet of water, you can get a prismatic effect. So depending on your orientation, Chris, you may be seeing some prismatic effect from the water vapor that's coming out of the back of the airliner.
That's a very sensible answer.
I'd add to that I spent quite a bit of time talking to jet engine people.
Yeah.
And there is nothing that can be put into a jet engine fuel that would come out the back that would not cause the jet engine to crash.
All right.
JP4 has got to be very, very pure.
And regarding the so-called Bermuda Triangle, Kevin Knuth, is this just a statistical anomaly or cherry-picking data? What do we got here?
Well, he was asking if there's one in the Atlantic. I think the Bermuda Triangle does go into the Atlantic.
Sure does.
But, it's probably a statistical fluke or cherry picking data, I guess I would say. I'm not sure. I don't think it's been properly studied. So.
Okay. Well, Chris, thanks a lot for that one. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. This email from Larry. Larry says, "Hey, great show," which probably was written quite some time ago. If time proceeds, Larry writes, "If time proceeds slower around a supermassive object like a black hole due to time dilation, is it true that the object exists in the past relative to our time frame?" And that's from Larry. Kevin, you're the physicist. Go ahead.
Well, that's a good question. And that leads to one of the difficult issues related to time, is that the idea that Isaac Newton had was that time is the same everywhere for everybody. And that was necessary for him to make progress on understanding mechanics. What we now understand since Einstein is that time is not the same everywhere for everybody. And that's what you see happening around a supermassive object. And it works actually with just any object. Time is actually going slower at the floor of the room you're in than it is at the ceiling. And you can measure this nowadays. You can actually take clocks that are sufficiently accurate, and as you move them up and down, you can actually see time differences on the order of nanoseconds. I mean, very tiny, but it's doable.
That's
so to say it's in the past isn't quite valid, because it's not. You can't actually define a future, a present. That's not. You can't say that your present here is the same as the present over there, and you can't compare times in different places. And that's very difficult.
It's that same frame of reference problem we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, but the other part of that question is the fact that there aren't any black holes near us. So the light from the black hole has to get to us, and it takes time to do that. So the black hole is what we're seeing for the black hole is certainly in the past, because it took, if it's 10 light years away, it took 10 years for that light to get to us.
But everything we see is in the past, right? It light travels at a certain speed, and then we have to process it at a certain speed. It's got to go through our nerves. Right. So everything we look, the present is the past, really.
Even the show is in the past.
Yes, well, soon enough. Yeah. This one is from Mark. Mark says, "With all due respect to Charles Darwin and everything that he has contributed to the sciences, his theory of evolution is still only a theory. Despite this, many science teachers present evolution to their students as fact. Why do teachers do this? Why not make sure the students understand that it's still a theory so they can make up their own minds?" And that's from Mark. Barbara Bravitz.
Sure. Darwin was kind of evolution 1.0, let me put it that way, in that, as we've talked about a lot today, science is iterative. We learn, we make a hypothesis, we test that hypothesis, we collect data, we draw conclusions from those data, and then perhaps the conclusions don't quite match what we thought they would be, and then we refine our hypothesis. So Darwin was, 130 years ago, thereabout. And we have come a long way since Darwin. A lot of the precepts that he had in his concept hold true. There are other pieces that do not. And so, like any branch of science, it's a branch of science that expands. Evolutionary biology is a branch of science. I mean, that's just like particle physics or meteorology. They're all branches of science. The comment that Mark made about let students make up their own mind, I think is a little bit of a challenge. And I think instead what we should say is let students understand that science is evolving and that they can participate in the process to refine the model even better. So that's, I guess, my comment.
Right. Anybody else want to comment on that?
Yeah, I guess I might add something about the phrase "just a theory." That's often used, and everything in science is just a theory. A theory is actually a very powerful thing. It's the most powerful thing we have, next to data, which we consider to be facts. So, scientific theories are built from hypotheses that have been tested over and over with many different types of data, not just one experiment, not just one find, but many finds. And theories are accepted only when they support each other. So science, you can think of science as a network of multiple theories that all tie into each other. So just like we were talking about muons earlier and how that's particle physics, the standard model is particle physics, but we're discussing the magnetic fields generated by muons, which is the theory of electromagnetism. So now you have a coupling between these two theories. They have to agree with each other. And the theory of evolution has to agree with other theories in biology. And that's what some of this iteration is to perfect that union. And so I think I usually feel a bit of a jolt when I hear the phrase "just a theory." A theory is a very powerful thing, and I don't think that that's always appreciated.
Ed, you want to say something before we go to the next one?
Oh, I was just going to say that science, to a good extent, is a house of cards, and as long as that house of cards holds, then you build upon it and you see what the next step is. And if the next step supports what you already have, then you're one step further towards understanding what the truth of the situation is. And theories are those cards, and they're what holds it all together. And if there weren't theories, there'd be no reason to do science. Science is all about producing theories and then testing them.
All right, one more email.
And as scientists, we try to train ourselves not to have biases, so that we affirm what we hold as convention to be true, so that we can be open to having pieces of our hypotheses or theories that are no longer holding true, that we can let go of them.
Right.
And a lot of that has happened in evolutionary biology with the advent of genetics. We've been able to look genetically at genetic changes within an organism or within a population of organisms. And a lot of that has refuted what the classical evolutionary model was. And we've been able to say, okay, we now know the classical evolutionary model was a good 1.0, but here we are at like version 14.0. We've come a long way.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Only about 5 minutes left, so we'll dispense with the emails now and get back to the phones. Many people have been waiting a long time. Lynn in Shelburne Falls. Lynn, you're on.
Yes, hello. Thank you so much. I've heard about our Earth changing poles or something like that.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how long that takes and how it actually happens and what's that all about.
Let's go to Ed Stander on this one.
Well, the last time it changed was about 14,000 years ago. And what happens effectively is that within the, and probably Kevin could explain this better than I can because he has better hands, but what effectively happens is that within the core of the Earth, there's a lot of liquid, of magnetic liquid. And so some of it goes in one direction, some of it spins in the other direction, and you add all those moments together, and you wind up getting effectively a north and a south pole. And all you have to do is have those moments change ever so slightly, and the pole will change position, or it can change direction. And when it happens, it's very difficult to say how long it takes, because what we do to determine how long it takes is we look at lava flows. And these lava flows effectively have magnetic crystals in them. And as the lava flow cools, it freezes those positions in place. So we can look at a series of lava flows and we can say how long it takes for this change to occur. We don't have fine enough detail to really be able to say that. But some scientists right now are arguing that with the way the poles are moving and the fact that our magnetic field is changing somewhat, it's becoming weaker, that we may be in an incipient changeover. It's generally speaking, they happen about every 10 to 20,000 years.
Okay, Lynn, let's now go to Mark in Remsen. Mark, you're on. Go ahead. You only got about 2 minutes here.
Okay, I'll try to make this quick. I have some space available to me to plant something, and I was wondering whether it'd be more beneficial for the environment to plant trees, grasses, or shrubs in an attempt to reduce the carbon dioxide put out, and what would be the most beneficial thing to plant?
Good question for this day. Barbara Brabitz.
Yeah, it is Earth Day today. when trees are young growing, they do an enormously fine job of sequestering CO2. That's the term that we use for them to absorb CO2 and turn it into plant material. And then that carbon dioxide is locked within, and of course they make oxygen as a bonus. what they do is during their lifespan, that CO2. I'm sorry?
The trees would take much longer to grow and actually be more productive, right?
Actually, when trees are young, they actually are a much better CO2 sink than when they're older. When they get to what you and I would think of like a shade tree size, their production of their sequestration of CO2 drops significantly. So a mature forest is almost carbon neutral. A young growing forest, like look at an abandoned farm field where all the trees are sprouting up, the sumacs, the birches, et cetera. That's a great sequestration. The problem is really the renewability of this, because you could do the same with grasses, right? You could grow a whole bunch of switchgrass in your yard and it will grab a lot of carbon dioxide. But at some point, that grass is going to rot. And when it decomposes, the carbon that was locked within it is most likely going to go back to carbon dioxide. So it all has to do with how fast we cycle these sequestrations and releases. So the thing about trees is it kind of slows the cycle down a bit. Actually, algae is pretty good at this. And one of the things about algae is that when algae, say we just take phytoplankton out in the ocean, they're in the ocean, so they emit their carbon dioxide into the ocean, not necessarily into the air. Now, carbon dioxide from the ocean can go in the air. I'm sorry, I just did the reverse. When they rot, then the CO2 goes into the ocean.
Okay.
CO2 from the ocean goes to the air, of course, but it's not a molecule for molecule exchange.
All right. So well, listen, I'm afraid
if we're looking at CO2 in the air, that algae and trees.
I guess we'll have to leave it there. Barbara Brabitz, thank you for being here. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Ray.
And you know, Ed didn't do, he didn't cause the trouble I thought he would, so you had a good suggestion to bring him on.
I never do.
Oh, really? All right. Well, Ed Standard, thank you for being here, sir. Okay, he's gone.
A pleasure.
I've offended him already. Kevin Knuth, that was your first time on the Science Forum. Is it your last time, sir? Let's find out.
Oh, certainly not. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you all for being here. That was a lot of fun. Thanks to everybody for calling. Support comes from Studio KTM Organic Hair Salon. Red Hook, by appointment only for private one customer in the salon at a time. Reservations with cutter and colorist Kristen Marquette. StudioKTM.com. And the Tang Teaching Museum at Art Gallery at Skidmore College, supporting the community with a temporary closure and continuing to explore art and ideas online. For projects and resources, skidmore.edu/tang. Once again, thanks to Barbara, Kevin, and Ed for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phone screened by Amber Sickles, our producer Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the program, well, you know, it's a Friday, so that makes it a Food Friday. And tomorrow, we welcome back old buddy of ours, Jennifer Clare, who will discuss a wide array of things, which I'm not sure what they are, but we'll find out at 2 tomorrow.